Welcome to Glyndebourne Festival Podcast 2009. Edward Seckerson talks to Sarah Connolly, Danielle Denise and conductor Lawrence Cummings about this summer's revival of David McVicar's acclaimed production of Handel's Giulio Cesare.
Lawrence Cummings' Giulio Cesare was the first and the most lavish of the three operas that Handel presented to his adoring public at the King's Theatre in London. I think it was 1724. An amazing year, but it is the grandest, isn't it, of his...
It is. Right from the moment it starts, the bright key of A major for the overture somehow just gives you that impression that you're in for a night full of sumptuous glamour and real sort of surprises. Already in the chorus at the beginning, you have the new kids on the block, the horns, a relatively recent addition to the orchestra. I mean, obviously people have been used to hearing it in hunting calls, but suddenly there were these players who could play this sort of virtuosic music. And of course Handel exploits it throughout the course of the opera.
Yes. Just give us an idea of the complete orchestral palette, because it's not just the horns. I mean, there is effectively a double orchestra, isn't there?
Absolutely. Which is interesting because Handel uses, I think, deliberately archaic instruments. You have the viola da gamba and the harp, the theorbo, and as well as strings and oboe on stage. And the magical effect of having the two orchestras, the one in the pit and then the one on stage, sort of speaking to each other, of course, with Cleopatra's wonderfully beautiful,
this
melodious...
This is the scene where she's trying to woo, seduce Caesar.
Indeed, and Vadoro, and she's, I think one could say she's certainly succeeding. And then the orchestras speak to each other, and then, of course, when they play together, there's the obvious metaphor of Cleopatra and Caesar, how can one put it, making beautiful music together.
Danielle Denise, I think it would be a massive understatement to say that you turned heads with your Cleopatra back in 2005. I mean, it was the kind of debut that singers dream of. And what was interesting to me, seeing it just unsuspectingly and cold like that, is that, you know, it looked like the production had been built around you. How did the role become yours, first of all?
Well, I was actually scheduled to make my debut at Glyndebourne as Adela in Die Fledermaus. And then in 2005, in maybe about April, I got a phone call from my manager saying that Glyndebourne, who had already heard me in the audition, were in need of a Cleopatra and would I consider going there a year early to perform Cleopatra. To which I just said, well, oh my God, yes, I haven't sung Cleopatra for 3 years, and I would love to do that. Who's conducting? And I was told Bill Christie, who is a great mentor of mine, somebody I've worked with a lot and have a great working relationship with, as well as a personal relationship with. So this all seemed to be just perfect, and I just thought, well, wow, I feel so lucky to be in this position to go there and sing a role that I love so much.
She's a very exotic, beguiling creature.
Yes.
And the way Handel treats her, I mean, some people think that he underestimates her intelligence in the opera, but I think the journey she makes from being this coquettish seductress who's prepared to render unto Caesar whatever it takes to get her kingdom then deepens as it goes. The journey through those arias, because you've got, what, 8 arias in the piece?
Or? Yeah, I feel the same way, actually. I don't feel like he underestimated her at all. I think we need to see her playfulness to understand her youth, because what people miss about Cleopatra is that she was incredibly cultivated and a learned person. She spoke many languages, and she was already dealing with political affairs by the age of 18, but she was still 18. And what Handel really embraces in her is her youth and the coquette and the playfulness and the spitefulness that she has towards her brother and the teasing. And I think he captures that brilliantly in her first couple of arias, especially the first one, which is very poking. And I think we need that in order to really appreciate the moments when Cleopatra spiraled into these intrigues with Caesar that become much more serious than just political intrigues, but become actually affairs of the heart.
She has everything, really, Cleopatra. She starts off, obviously, she's very high in the hierarchy of Egyptian society. She's obviously had a very privileged upbringing. And yet, partly, I suspect, because of the nature of her relationship with Ptolemy, her brother, she's not the most attractive person. And she's prepared to be very manipulative in order to get her own way and to become queen. All the way through, of course, she has brilliant music. She has fantastic coloratura arias, melodious tunes to sing. But in fact, she, I think, goes on the most incredible journey through the opera because she seduces Caesar. He's totally overcome by her charms, and rather lovelyly that they are musical charms as well as the beauty. But in fact, when Caesar actually goes off to war, and she fears for him. You can tell she has genuinely fallen for him.
Yeah, she didn't expect to fall in love.
No, and I think that's one of the lovely parts about it is, and it's all in the music, she suddenly finds herself in love. And it's definitely, I think, for her the first time this has happened. And she's certainly not expecting it because, I mean, he's an old man compared to her.
In David McVicar's production, he's found a more contemporary equivalent for Roman domination in the British Empire. And the Raj, which is quite cunning, really, because we have more proximity to it.
Absolutely.
And we can relate
yes.
to it.
And yet, at the same time, it gives us an old world feeling.
Sarah Connolly,
hi.
Should I say, Hail the Conquering Hero, also known as Giulio Cesare. I suppose, Sarah, it takes an audacious Scot to set up the English as the substitute for Romans with world dominations on their minds.
Yes, David has an extraordinary vision for this opera, and it is quite amusing that he's chosen the British army, I should say. Well, it is audacious. I mean, it's not always the most glorious chapter in our history in many respects, but it really works, I think.
Brings it
subject.
Much closer
yes,
to this, doesn't
it?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember when he first presented the idea? Because you were in the original production back in, what was it, 2005?
Mm. Well, there had been rumours circulating before, so it wasn't a complete surprise. That it was sort of turn of the century, in 19th, 20th century, there would be some allusion to this sort of the Great War. And then there were also rumours of Carry On Cleo, and he resented that very much. He just cheapened his idea of the bigger picture. But I just remember thinking every time, as we all did, yes, what a great idea, and then he'd present another... he'd say what was happening in another aria, and then Bill Christie would shriek from somewhere at the back of the room saying, at last we have a director who's following the sort of curves and the flow of the music, and he's not going to interfere.
Yes. And I think that one of the challenges of opera seria with all its extraordinary conventions
yes.
and implausibilities
yes.
is that one has to take it at face value, but at the same time you've got to find a deeper emotional truth
yes.
in it, haven't you? And
yes.
I think that is the challenge. And the audacity of David is he plays a dangerous game in that he does actually slightly send up the conventions
yes.
while taking the emotions very seriously. Would you
yes.
say that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I'd say that's a perfectly fair assessment. He explores every scene, every challenge to its limit, every... emotion, every thought that we bring as well. I mean, he doesn't come with a set idea of an aria. He has a loose idea and a structure that he's more than happy to go with what people offer, and the more they bring to the table, the better it is. That's great for me.
Tell us about that amazing, I mean, she really lays on the seduction, the whole Mount Parnassus thing.
Yes.
I love the moment in David's production where you, having been duly seduced, rush through these parting curtains, these silk curtains. It's like a sort of metaphor for the Red Sea almost.
Yes.
It's just amazing.
Well, he's dropped 20 years. In 5 minutes, he's lost, you know, the sort of cares of the world and the responsibilities, and he's just feeling joys of new love. And she's awoken this sort of sensuality in him, and he enjoys his tea and his coffee, and he's very happy. It's a sort of bucolic feel, and I think that the freshness and sweetness of that aria is a masterstroke again, to have that after the sort of rather heavy seduction, the sort of the musky beauty of that scene and the evocation of the night, to suddenly have the morning coffee. Of course, it's perfect. Yeah. And David understood that, of course, and passing the teacup and or the coffee cup, and you know, two sugars, please. it's just the light touch again.
A lot of the humour that David brings is in the music. I mean, it really sort of is heightened by what's already there. For instance, for Caesar, singing the Same Fiorita with the solo violin, again, this unusual texture that we talked about earlier. The violin is imitating Caesar, and they're both imitating birdsong. And you can just tell that the original would have had a lot of fun, you know, that the violinist would have imitated the singer and vice versa. And David's really sort of capitalised on that by putting the violinist on stage.
And he's also seized the opportunity for big song and dance numbers too, and there's a kind of wonderful cheeky twist on the Baroque style with a touch of Bollywood in
the
big
it's
number.
It's so appropriate because all these arias are in dance form. You know, they all come from dances. So again, it's just bringing something that's already there and, yes, updating it, but updating it in order to make it exotic, and of course that's what it was.
When I came to the first day, that was when I met David, really, the very first day of rehearsals. And it was a lovely meeting, and it was a very business-like meeting in that, you know, there was work to be done. So he sort of met me and said, hello, nice
David.
To meet you,
yeah.
Very, very glad you're here. Come on, get up on stage, let's get going.
Yeah.
And that was it. The first rehearsal was the entire first scene of Cleopatra and Ptolemy and her first aria, which was fully choreographed, you know, to come on the first day and have that. But we got through it quite quickly. I somehow grasped these moves very quickly. I've had some dance training, so I was up for the challenge. And we had some time left over. And that's sort of how the vibe of the rehearsals got going. I was very enthusiastic, obviously. David was, Andrew George, the choreographer, was. And so we sort of set out then after that to work with what we could possibly build on. Well, a lot of the rhythms are dance rhythms,
exactly.
And David is very passionate about that aspect of it. It's not just a fluffy Bollywood choreographed for the sake of it piece, which is how some people might look at it if they look at it sort of from the outside as a quick way of describing it. But actually, it's incredibly rooted dramatically in the story. There are many, many intense, intense scenes. And yes, there are a few scenes that are choreographed. And they actually really, really work and enhance the colors that Handel put in the music. So they really add a third dimension to what is already there. Mm. So it's been so wonderful to be a part of it.
She doesn't expect to fall in love with Caesar, does she?
No, I don't think so. I think she goes in with tactic, and she goes with different kinds of weapons, of charm, of ambition, of political guile. She goes in with these tools, and she finds herself romantically attached and attracted to this person in a way that she could never have imagined, and that unravels her. So by the time we get to Act 2, she is lost. She's lost because she doesn't understand what it's like to not have control over things. Yeah. She's able to control a lot of things in her life, but not her heart.
That's there's that wonderful aria Sapietà.
Yeah, that's exactly
which
the
is,
moment.
You know, where she thinks his life is in danger and she may lose him.
Well, Sapietà is very difficult because at that point in the piece, so much has happened, and at the final moment where she thinks it's going to be the height of seduction, news comes from Curio of betrayal and that the forces are rising against Caesar and they're looking for his head, basically. And in a flash, I mean, it's an aria's worth of time, but it feels like an instant, he's gone. And she's trying to get him to put away his sword and still trying to gain control back of the situation. He realizes there are bigger things at play here and he goes off to battle. And all of a sudden, she's left completely alone. She can't click her fingers and make anything happen right now. That's what I find the most striking about it, is that she's always able to send everybody, control this, get that, do this. And this is this one moment where that introduction I always find when I'm on stage and singing Sapietà, it feels eternal because she can't do anything. She has no control. She doesn't even have control of her feelings, actually. So she's really helpless. What I also find very challenging is, I mean, obviously I have to sing this aria lying horizontal. It's very difficult. I'm very involved in the character by this moment, and I'm not interested in adjusting for comfort or making sure the hair is not in my face or up my nose or whatever it may be. It happens, and it can be quite uncomfortable, but I like the idea of embracing that difficultness.
Yes.
And staying with the character, because I don't think Cleopatra would be even concerned with those kind of things at that moment. When I get to the end of that piece, it's one of those few moments where, as an actor, you really can't just switch off and just be bouncy right after. You do need a second to just breathe out, really, because so much of that aria, the way in which it's written even, is very suspended. It's always leading to a question mark. It's always these phrases that are conditional. They never end. And I think she's incredibly exposed. I feel very exposed, obviously.
It's the way... Well, I was going to say that Handel peels back the layers of Cleopatra and reveals more and more as the opera goes on.
But that's the first aria where we really see Cleopatra in a very naked sense.
A lot of this music was incredibly original and amazing. When you compare it to his contemporaries, I mean, there were some other good composers writing opera seria in London, but Handel really, really stands out as being daring and unusual. And I think that's what is so brilliant about this production, because it takes exactly the same risks that Handel took.
I think he'd have loved Bollywood, actually.
Yes, I do.
What's Cleopatra's big number in the last scene, where it goes for broke?
Absolutely. Da Tempeste, and it's been fun rehearsing Da Tempeste, because as great composers do, Andrew George, the choreographer, is making little changes here and there, and it's been really fun to watch that process happening. It's a working, living form, because indeed, you know, when composers used to copy out their own music, they never copied it out verbatim. They always made little changes because they can't help themselves. They're composers, you know.
Yeah.
Oh!
very easy. When you know something well and you love it, you sort of want to camp it up a little bit. And David will always come back at us and go, no, no, no. Act three is the most difficult act. It's where the stakes are high. We must never, ever play the joke. You have to take it seriously. Let the audience see the irony of that, you know? But it's hard. And, you know, you get to Das Empeste, and yeah, I sort of knew this, but had never really turned around to really take it in, the Zeppelin sort of coming in and during the B section. I'm singing all about this very intense stuff about sort of Cleopatra recovering, between pain and between comfort, and her soul returning to sort of beat and palpitate again with this news of triumph. And you know, I hear people laughing, but I can't live that laugh. So I'm in this very, like, you know, my goal in that minute is to say to them, you have no idea what I've been through. This is what I've been through. Now that I've been through all of this, my triumph is sweeter. So, you know, it's amazing. It's a journey. And I think he strikes a perfect balance between that comedy and the drama. I mean, there's some moments in this show when, you know, you'd never know that 10 minutes before that there was a dance routine.
Yeah.
You would just be completely sucked in to the plight of these characters, like Cornelia, Sesto.
Yes.
When Aquila dies, it's like, it's quite intense, you know? It's wonderful to watch it now. So I've seen scenes now that I'd never seen because I was always in a quick change booth or something. So it's great.